Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll be exploring more of the cultures of consciousness. I've been away for a couple of weeks. It's good to be back. I was visiting Greece, which has its own definite esoteric vibration. It's kind of interesting how going to ancient ruins the quest to kind of find some resonance, some sense of a lingering presence and atmosphere, an invocation in the midst of the hordes of sweating tourists, and your own identity as a sweating tourist. Can't ever forget that you are part of the picture, and it's a great practice, actually, to these days when so many sacred sites are also sites of mass tourism, to kind of figure out your own way to open up to the spirit of place and whatever lingering resonances remain in the landscape. And it's kind of an art as well, a simultaneous art of the sacred and the profane. And in a way, that's part of the message, if there is such a thing, of this show, is learning the tricks of the trade, the art of discovering connections, resemblances, resonances behind the sometimes extremely quotidian and profane surface of modern life, without denying the reality of that surface, without pretending that we're in a magic land of enchantment, because there is such a strong sense of reality going down all over the planet, and that was certainly the case in Greece as well, with the sense of the economic crisis being extraordinarily palpable on the streets of the cities and towns and in the conversations with so many people. I gave a really excellent, had a really fun time giving a talk at a bookstore on Philip K. Dick and esoteric topics, and I was very impressed with the audience. You know, you don't really know. You go to some foreign country and someone gathers together a couple dozen people and you talk about stuff, and you never really know what kind of questions you were going to get, and I was very impressed with the sophistication of the esoterica and philosophical questions that were coming my way. But in also having conversations with these folks afterwards, it was remarkable how quickly things got to the very difficult situations of that land, and indeed of the world, the economic immigration, rise of neo-fascism in Europe, which of course has its own complicated relationship with esotericism. So it seems that these topics follow us and trick us everywhere we go, and I look forward to exploring that more today. We're going to be talking with David Metcalf about esotericism. I sort of encountered David's work first on Twitter, where I regularly show my head, though I am by no means a total fiend of the medium. One of the things I like about Twitter is, in fact, the way that you can just drop it for a while and you don't feel like you've left, the garden is not being watered, because it just stops, and then immediately you start up again and people start responding and things start bouncing around, and it's so overwhelming it doesn't really matter if you there's no way to catch up or keep up with it. So when I went away for my trip, I'm like, just let it go. So I enjoy this kind of cavalier attitude towards social media, much more healthy than the kind of obsessiveness that I see so many people falling into, although sometimes the obsessiveness is really cool, like the kind of stuff that David Metcalf does, because this guy blogs and tweets like a maniac on a whole wide range of esotericism. If you're interested in these kinds of topics, I heartily encourage you to follow his Twitter feed, because it's just full of juicy materials. And so I'll be looking forward to talking to him about exploring these matters in our media meltdown world today. But first, we'll bring on the co-host of Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja, welcome to the show.
Hi, Eric. Thanks. Welcome
to you. So I missed you. How was the last few weeks in your esoteric or quotidian and or quotidian life?
It was great, although I didn't obsess much about social media. I tend to be like you. You know, I just do it, and it's fun, but I'm not like, I don't have one of those fancy phones, so I'm not like constantly just like, no.
You have a dumb phone.
I do. I have a dumb phone.
Yeah, I have a dumb phone, too.
I've witnessed friends where we'll be doing something and they can't put their phone down, man. And I mean, as much as I love obsessing over information and like getting in touch with people, I think it's kind of jacking people up a little bit how obsessive they get on the twit stuff. So.
Yeah, it's a funny thing the way the devices. I mean, for me, I think it's partly the way the devices intrude on other kinds of spaces, and they really transform the way we move through space. Which, you know, some people want to defend or even kind of celebrate, but I have more difficulty with that. And yet there's a definite power to the kind of proximity to this overwhelming flow of information and learning your own kind of skills of how to navigate it. It's almost like a kind of Bardo practice.
So, true, it is.
I can't get too grumpy on it. And you had an Expanding Mind show with how did that go?
Oh, I did. Yeah, we talked to Paul Hardiker, who runs the Alchemy Journal and a really cool esoteric publishing company. So he's just knee deep in esoterica himself and knows all kinds of practicing alchemists that are actually doing the physical lab work. I know a lot of people these days, everything's all Jungian and spiritual and frou-frou, but it's important to remember that there are still people who set up their laboratories and are doing the old school stuff with lead and gold and the whole thing.
And all the spagyrics, too, the people you're doing plant alchemy and extractions.
They're taking painstaking attention to where the planets are and what plants are what and what part of the body it goes to and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and even working it in ways that you know, resemble other things that people do that they don't think of as alchemy, like distilling or creating essential oils or all these other kinds of practices that are increasingly, you know, popular in our DIY crafting world that really overlap some of the kind of physical practices of alchemy. In fact, a lot of ways I think we're kind of moving out of that sort of Jungian, heady, kind of almost intellectual sort of way of looking at these things, and it seems like a lot of the cutting edge stuff is happening a little bit closer to the ground.
Yeah, people want something that works, not just something they can think about.
Exactly. Well, I think that's a great question, comment to lead us into our talk with David. So, David, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hey, thanks, guys. Great to be on here.
Yeah, it's really fun. I've had it this time a couple of times where I just encounter somebody online and start following their work and kind of go, this guy's going to be interesting. And now I have a forum, a medium, a way to create a conversation and find out more about these folks. So I'm really happy you joined us. So just to kind of introduce yourself a little bit, maybe talk a little bit about what kind of pies you have fingers in at the moment and how you sort of conceive your work as a writer and commentator and sort of a researcher of the contemporary esoteric space.
Sure. You and I both have pieces in the Edge Realms anthology that just came out from Evolver and North Atlantic Book.
Yeah, that's a good thing to mention. That's a lot of the pieces were originally on Reality Sandwich and are out in the Evolver book series, which we've had other authors on the show. And it's I haven't seen the whole thing yet. Have you seen it? Does it look good?
I haven't seen the whole book. I actually, hopefully that'll be shipping soon. I saw when they did the edits, they sent back kind of like a chunk edit of a bunch of different chapters. So I saw Dean Radin's chapter, and Timothy Wiley has a chapter in there.
Excellent.
So I saw some of that, and it all looks really, really interesting. I think Russell Tarr
what did you write about
in there too. I wrote about narratives, the science of magic, and narratives of the paranormal. So kind of the Jeffrey Kripal work mm-hmm. idea, and then going into paranthropology, which is a kind of new spin on transpersonal anthropology, specifically looking at parapsychological, you know, poltergeist events, spirit mediumship, and that kind of stuff, but from a experiential view.
So when you say when you use the term anthropology in that context, what does it mean? How does that differ, let's say, than just, you know, the kind of paranormal investigation that, you know, people have been doing for decades?
Sure. Jack Hunter, who started the Paranthropology Journal, he went to a Bristol Spirit Lodge and actually learned for his, I believe it was his master thesis, he actually learned the trance mediumship and then had kind of an ethnographic experience with the mediums there where he didn't just, you know, test them in the lab. There's a place in Arizona called the Winbridge Institute where they actually test mediums in the lab and, you know, do double-blind testing on are they actually getting anomalous information in that. Well, Jack went and did more ethnography with it, where he actually learned the techniques, you know, went to the spiritist group and spent time with them, and then did some really cool video work with them and, you know, wrote up his experiences in that. So, paranthropology.
Totally interesting, you know, a point almost along the lines of what we were just talking about with Maja about the difference between kind of intellectual and practical approaches to these esoteric matters. I mean, one of the problems with parapsychology is that it's sort of been locked into this scientific framework where it's only valid if it gets proven in some kind of replicable laboratory solid way, and even though there have been positive signs and some evidence data coming out of that approach, in a way we kind of miss a much larger question, which is the way in which these practices and pursuits always take place inside of, you know, grounded human contexts. And if you go and look at these different kinds of contexts, different kinds of evidence will arise. I mean, I know one of the things you're pursuing in your work is kind of the connection between parapsychology and esotericism, and I don't want to overly confuse those two. So maybe we'll stay with the parapsychology for a little bit. But give me a sense of how you see the field and the discussion changing out of the kind of, you know, maybe we can think about the 70s when there's sort of an upswell of people interested in spoon bending and powers of the mind, and then a sort of response of hectoring critics like the amazing Randy, who are, you know, this kind of, you know, snarky skepticism, which has...
I love that someone that calls themselves the amazing Randy is a skeptic.
The amazing Cranky.
he is real cranky, too.
So how do you see things changing now?
Well, and it's exactly what you said. I mean, a lot of the interesting stuff that parapsychology looks at really is a kind of, well, and I think you were talking about it, you know, as you introduced the show, just that the mundane level, you know, I mean, is, you know, the psi, you know, the idea that, you know, psychic spies, like, that's kind of cool, you know, that has like a cool element to it. But really people have, you know, the telephone telepathy or telephone, like, precognition things where you know that your mom's going to call, you know, stuff like that. And it really is, there's a really mundane level to this stuff. And, you know, especially if you look at the mediumship, you know, in shamanic cultures and that, cultures that still have that, you know, like in Brazil, spiritism has mixed with Santeria, so it's, you know, espiritismo. Or that may be more Dominican, but, you know, I mean, they have this inner relationship, and it's a very communal practice. And so understanding it, how it affects, you know, just your everyday life and living in that, I think that gets more towards the ideas of human potential and that kind of stuff a lot of times than testing it in a lab and doing that lab testing. And it seems like there's, you know, Jeffrey's work really focuses on that narrative level of it, and it seems like there's more of a view towards that. And what they found, what Jack has pointed out in his work and some of the people that he works with and that write for Paranthropology, is that, you know, even somebody like Stanley Krippner, who's big in the parapsychology field, a lot of times what they were doing was anthropological studies, you know, when they would go down to South America and that. And that bringing that back into the, you know, everyday life of people, you know, in the U.S. or in Britain or in, you know, Europe and that, and seeing how these things affect stuff.
Yeah, you know, and another dimension of that anthropology element of it, which I think is really key, is that in anthropology you have this idea of the participant observer, that it is a valid if controversial practice in anthropology. If you're going to go into another culture, you know, inevitably, in order to communicate at all, you have to begin to learn and appreciate the sort of local language, which isn't just verbal language, but a whole way of being in the world, gestural, referential, energetic. And, you know, some anthropologists go and do this, and they totally maintain 100% their Western secular materialist view. But many anthropologists, and sometimes against their own desires, find themselves slipping into this liminal space, a kind of twilight realm between their scientific models and the kind of spiritist or supernatural models of the people that they're working with. And I know there's some really remarkable accounts of anthropologists sort of coming out of the closet, acknowledging that they have had these experiences, even against their desire to have those experiences.
Right.
It just starts to happen. So clearly there's something about the way that human beings collectively weave together their reality that plays on or stages some of this phenomena.
Right. And that actually goes back into the lab work, too, because if you look at the work of, like, William Roll, who did a lot of work with poltergeist phenomenon, and Barry Taff, who did a lot of work with poltergeist and haunting stuff, or Lloyd Orbach, what they've gained from studying poltergeist phenomenon is that a lot of times, they have what they call the agent, and that is the kind of center point for the poltergeist phenomenon. And it seems to be some kind of interaction between a certain, you know, personality type or a person in an environment that's conducive to it can cause, you know, these effects, like stuff flying around the room. And it can get more intense than that, but, you know, the stuff flying around the room was kind of easier to look at. And, you know, once you start having apparitions and people getting scratches on their body, that kind of moves out of their realm of theory. But, you know, that participant in the environment within the social setting seems to have a lot to do with when this stuff is effective or when it actually has a physical effect.
Well, and that's what's so interesting to me is that, I mean, that's the whole problem with scientific experiments, right? And this is not just true of paranormal stuff, but let's say they're doing tests on, like, measles or something, and they're in a lab, and they have it in a little Petri dish, and they're trying to test, like, how measles react in the environment. But all of the results they get are nothing like how it is out, you know, when it gets loose into a natural environment. It behaves differently. So I don't understand why it's such a big leap for people like James Randi to understand that environmental conditions have effects on it, just like they would if it was E. coli or chickenpox or anything.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, too, is the parapsychology stuff, I've always kind of had an interest in it, but you know, as you mentioned, my focus is more esoteric philosophy and that kind of stuff. So coming in recently, I went to the Parapsychological Association's conference, and I was surprised at the science because I encountered all these skeptical things. And as I was looking at what they were presenting scientifically, it's really odd because, you know, for instance, the poltergeist stuff's moving around the room. You know, I mean, they have evidence. Stuff's moving around the room. There's no sleight of hand. It's not somebody hoaxing it. They have thousands of cases where this has been proven, and yet we still, if you walk up to somebody on the street, they'll say either I believe in poltergeists or I don't believe. But it really seems from the scientific investigation of this stuff, something's going on that we can't explain. There's some kind of anomalous, you know, things are moving.
Right.
And there's been incidents with human blood plasma coming out of the walls. How do you hoax that? You know, I mean, how does a single mom suddenly make blood plasma come out of her wall? You know, that's not really hoaxable. You know, so it's very interesting to see that, and to see the way that we have these narratives where it's like, you know, well, this isn't this, you know, the whole skeptical narrative is, it's very strange when you actually look at the science behind this stuff or the remote viewing stuff. I mean, some of the evidence that they got for the remote viewing stuff is really provocative, and to completely dismiss it as, you know, oh, well, that's just, you know, a guess or whatever. I mean, some of the stuff, Stephen Schwartz, some of his results in that are, they're pretty intense to be just, you know, guesswork or putting together some clues as to what could possibly be happening. And
Part of the problem is, as far as I understand, and this is, you know, I'm not an expert in, is different views of how evidence works and how statistics work. Because it's
right.
Like, you can, you know, a skeptic would go, sure, there's anecdotal evidence for all sorts of things. You know, there's, we see, you know, there are these sort of anomalous things, and it's not even claiming that they're a lie or a hoax, but it's just because they're not repeatable in a certain way, or because the statistics, because of how you interpret them, you kind of can still hold on to this narrative. But, you know, a scientist who's being honest about what they're claiming, you know, in contrast to the sort of visible public skeptics, to my mind, their response and even their skepticism will be much more, it will be more nuanced. It's more on the level of, like, statistics and evidence. But what we see in the mainstream is this profound ideological war where there are these foot soldiers of skepticism who want ordinary people not to be induced into the liminal twilight zone of possibility. And it's a remarkable. Do you see that shifting at all? Or, you know, especially, because then immediately this gets into this question, which again, I think you... I'm sure you have interesting things to say about how these ideas, how this information, how these different narratives are being circulated through our, you know, crazy, overwhelming media space. Because clearly things are changing, and yet on the surface it seems like they're not, but it's hard to tell. I mean, what's your sense of how these contrasting narratives are playing themselves out?
I think that we're at a point where, because of the media sphere, that is, we're kind of at a breaking point with that. And that was something with the ties between the esoteric philosophy and the parapsychology. If back to, like, the Society for Psychical Research, Henry Bergson, his sister was Moina Mathers. So Moina Mathers, who was for a while the head of the Golden Dawn, was the sister of one of the, one, leading philosophers of the time, and two, one of the founders of the Society for Psychical Research. So there's ties, if you go back to the 1800s, between esoteric philosophy, and it even goes up into the 20s and 30s, where people like Paul Sadier and some of the French Gnostic tradition had an interest in parapsychology and were active in it. And even up until, I want to say the 70s, and that there were certain individuals that were very heavily into, you know, the French Gnostic tradition, some of the Sufism that was coming through, like Henri Corbin, and that. And I think that's coming back because these people are starting to have conversations again because of the way the media is bringing everybody together. You know, for instance, I'm in contact with the people at Phoenix Rising Digital Academy, where you went over to Greece, and Sasha hosted that. Sasha Chaitow, who founded Phoenix Rising, hosted that, you know, so I have connections there, plus connections with, you know, some of the people in the parapsychological field. So bringing these in together and bringing that conversation together is stuff like what, you know, Jeffrey Kripal's doing, where it's not as cut and dry anymore, you know, and because people can have multiple interests. And, you know, Jacques Vallée, who, if you look at his work, he doesn't make a difference between any of it. You know, all his work covers the whole deal, including ufology and, you know, all that stuff.
And information science. Yeah, he's a great example of how these different narratives come together. I mean, I've been trying to get him on the show forever. I know Jacques, but he's very elusive. But he's a marvelous example. And, you know, anyone who's interested in his work, it's well worth tracking down Jeff Kripal's chapter on Valet in Authors of the Impossible, which, you know, again, does a wonderful job of weaving that tapestry that you're talking about. But in a way, this brings us back to the question of anthropology. I mean, when we think about, like, anthropology, you go out and you look at weird cultures in the jungle somewhere or whatever, and we forget, of course, that we ourselves are part of anthropological networks. We have our own rituals and rites and symbol systems and crazy ideas that are, you know, distributed through the world. And partly what you're saying about this weaving together of art and science and technology and experiment and music and these sort of networks that you described that were very obvious in the late 19th century with occultism and have kind of waxed and waned throughout the last 100-150 years, that in a way, what that's saying, this emphasis that you're making on weaving together these different perspectives, is to kind of affirm the active cultivation of our own anthropological networks.
Right.
Rather than saying, oh yeah, there's a laboratory, we're going to do a test, we're going to prove it once and for all. Well, that's not how science works anyway. And besides, all of that in some ways is beside the point, because we're also weaving these cultural narratives that have actual real effects on people's lives.
Right. And it's, you know, like Ferdinando, who you guys had on, the work that he's doing was just showing how sleight of hand can have such a massive change in somebody's worldview, you know, or Jeff McBride in that. I mean, what they're doing with, you know, stage magic as a way to bring about, you know, Ferdinando talked about, you know, bringing wonder and bringing astonishment into people's lives, and that brings them into that liminal state, you know. I think that one of the important things to look at, too, is when you bring it into the lab, you're looking for a physical effect, and it may not be a physical effect. I mean, if you look at, like, UFO phenomenon and that, there's a huge psychological component to it. David Halperin has done a lot of work with Jungian quaternities in UFO symbolism and stuff. There's a huge psychological component to it that's important whether or not you can actually get a physical, you know, proof of the event. And I think that that's, you know, as this conversation deepens and as people can, you know, because it's amazing now, I mean, just that we can talk to so many different people with social media, you know, like Paul Hardacre, have, you know, had very brief conversations with him online, just you can have that now, you know, whereas he's in Thailand and it may have been, you know, 10 years ago, there's no way I would have been talking to him, you know, so...
Well, I'm curious how you see your particular role, you know, how you conceive of what you're doing, because you see this network happening, you see these conversations happening, and you put yourself into the matrix, if you will, the network, in a certain kind of way. So as you get a better understanding of how these things are going, are evolving, how the narratives are evolving, how do you see your role and where do you kind of want to go with your sense of things?
Well, I think that, yeah, I actually came into it. I've had like a decade of corporate marketing experience. So I came into it because there was a point in time where I could either write a business blog, or I was working for a marketing agency at the time, and I'm actually fairly low tech. So I wasn't really interested in being engaged in that, you know. I didn't want to be out there like that. And but working at the marketing agency, it was a choice of either, you know, doing business blogging or writing about what I was actually interested in. And I started out trying to write local, you know, local business pieces on, you know, community engagement and that. And I just wasn't feeling it. So I decided to be honest and actually start talking about, you know, what I was interested in, and that's led, you know, through until now, where, you know, I'm contributing editor with Reality Sandwich. We're trying to build a parapsychology feature series, you know, trying to get more of the science out there, and a more responsible coverage and get people engaged with that stuff. Because, I mean, like, remote viewing, you can learn the protocols. It's not, you know, this isn't secret stuff. And there's ways to train in it and that. So getting that information out there, because there's this community, you know, the consciousness culture is engaged in that. And I think a lot of people don't realize what's available to them. And so, you know, having worked for corporations and doing marketing and stuff like that, I kind of want to use what I know from that to bring this information out so that people can use it, you know, so that people can encounter it, so that, you know, it's not just a one-year span of what happened a year ago, but, you know, with Twitter and that, I try to pull back, you know, some of the articles that are available from the 1800s, you know, because there's interesting information out there. Or, you know, with alchemy, you were talking about Jungian alchemy versus the practical alchemy, and getting that information out there so that, you know, it's available, it's floating around the web. And, you know, the Internet's wonderful for kind of anything that gets placed in it, it kind of reciprocates and moves it around, you know. So just being in that, getting the information into the stream so that people can access it and then, you know, use it for their own, whatever they need it
well,
for.
Well, and that's really, I mean, it's a real big key to the esoteric tradition, because part of why things go esoteric in the first place is because people can't get access to them. So it kind
right.
of goes underground, and a huge portion of our consciousness as human beings gets like shoved under there. It's like China. Like, China's figured out everything basically, like over the history of its time. And then we're spending so much time just redoing all this stuff that China already did, like maybe hundreds of years ago. So with the esoteric tradition on the Internet, we don't have to keep figuring out what they already know and have known in China, but they got, you know, every dynasty change, it got eradicated or blown up or whatever. So we have this opportunity to just hoist all that out and say, here, look at this, you know?
Right, exactly. Well, and that's you wrote the book with, his name is escaping me.
About the
New Thought movement. And it's amazing to look at the history of the New Thought movement and how deep that goes. And what they were actually dealing, I mean, it's hermetic, it's practical hermeticism.
Exactly.
But, you know, you look at it now and you see The Secret and you're like, oh, well, that's kind of cheesy. But if you look back at, like, William Walker Atkinson, or, you know, even Napoleon Hill has some stuff in there that's really interesting, the streams that someone like Napoleon Hill with Think and Grow Rich was tapping into, you know, because he talks about, you know, the sixth sense being key to business.
He totally has psychical phenomenon in his book on how to get rich. Totally.
Yeah. And I was totally shocked by that because, you know, I encountered Think and Grow Rich from business people. And I actually did an article where I sent out a request for business people to respond, you know, well, what do you guys think about the telepathy and the sexual transmutation? Like, I've never heard any of you talking about this book, you know, engage with these aspects. And most of the people who've read it didn't read that part, or if they read that part, they didn't even think about it. And now it's a whole portion of the book. It's kind of the capstone on his book.
It's like how to do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I was amazed by that. And, you know, so, you know, you guys writing that book and putting that out there, that I think that really keys into it. Yeah, this stuff gets lost. It gets pushed under, you know, and
at the same time, like you say, it's also kind of hiding in plain sight, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting process of above and below. Well, there's a lot of great questions we've raised. This awesome conversation, but we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with David Metcalf about esotericism, paranormality, and the Internet. So we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, speaking with David Metcalf. And before the break, David, you had mentioned The Secret, which I know is such a stinker word these days, but one of my favorite things about The Secret in all of its audacity is that it's proof in and of itself that this stuff works and is practical and viable just by the sheer success of The Secret, which I thought was pretty hilarious. But I was wondering, like, people do want that kind of thing they can do. And, like, in the Napoleon Hill book, he gives explicit instructions on how to kind of use the mental component and the parapsychological component and things they can actually perform or kind of do. And I was wondering if you personally, kind of in a lot of your research, have found, you know, any techniques that you have tried or that you like or that have worked for you.
I've done some experiments with lucid dreaming techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that really, it opens up a different way to look at your involvement with reality. It's pretty powerful stuff, you know, if you work with that. Recently, I've been kind of engaged with, there's an artist, David Heim Smith.
Oh, yeah,
who,
totally.
Got an interesting take on Kabbalah. It's a little bit more Gnostic than what you normally encounter with Kabbalistic work. And that kind of thing is very interesting to me. I mean, he brings in kind of some Dzogchen techniques, which again goes back to the lucid dreaming and that. So it's interesting. I'm actually, right now, I'm kind of working with that, engaged with the parapsychological stuff, seeing where those things tie into, you know, esoteric meditation practices and that. I've been playing a little bit with Gonsfeld and some of the remote viewing protocols, just kind of dabbling with them. But
Let's talk a little more about that connection. I mean, you know, maybe, you know, one way into that is just, again, giving a kind of account of where you see esotericism today, these streams of hermetic magic, Gnosticism, Kabbalah, and, you know, New Thought, sort of, you know, practical magic, the occult, these streams that we can call esotericism. You know, they too are changing in our contemporary environment, and it seems like one of the things you're kind of mapping out is how they interact and with parapsychological approaches or phenomena, and I'm kind of curious how you see those things beginning to interweave, or is it a return to something that's always been there? You know, how do you see that dialogue happening?
I think that, I mean, because things are becoming more public, you can start to see the similarities. I mean, the remote viewing stuff is a good example, because Russell Targ points back to some yogic work that actually outlines even Gonsfeld practice. I think that there's kind of a, you know, syncretism gets a bad rap, but there's an underlying reality to us interacting with reality that's kind of covered in all the esoteric traditions. You know, I come from a comparative religion, cognitive philosophy background, and early on was really engaged with some of the Christian mysticism, like St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila and that, and you start to see these connections with what they're talking about, and Stephen Schwartz in his remote viewing work even draws back on that, where some of the things that they're experimenting with in the lab, you know, like you pointed out, Maja, was it's already been discovered, it's already been talked about, and, you know, Russell Targ is real open about that one of the best things to learn remote viewing is go back and learn some of the mental yoga, the Raja Yoga technique.
Totally.
You know, and I think that what's interesting to me is the combination, and this is pointed out in the Falconelli books, is that the next step is tying Western science with some of these, you know, Eastern or even, you know, medieval meditative techniques and that. And, you know, with the Falconelli work, it's really interesting. If you look at the circle around Falconelli, those guys were very engaged in actual science, like material sciences. And if you look back at the history of, I want to say Bayer, but it may not be Bayer, one of the pharmaceutical companies, a couple of them that have ties back into the 1700s, they started out in alchemy. And it goes from there. You know, it goes from this Spagyrix and that, this Spagyrix
work. Well,
the
word pharmacy means sorcery.
right,
like that's
the
etymology of it.
Right, and that's, you know, I mean, and that's exactly like the Dale Pendle's work, you know, with the pharmacopoeia stuff, you
yeah,
know, and,
exactly.
And looking back at that, and I think that now that we're all kind of having these conversations, that tie is possible again, and since fundamentalism has become so separated from anything, you know, I mean, fundamentalism, whether it's Islamic fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism or even Hindu fundamentalism, has separated itself out into this kind of separate category, that the more practical aspects and stuff can come out, you know, and have and start to move that way too, and then mix with some of the more open scientific ideas and that. And that's really exciting to me right now, is this ability to look at the lab tests that they're doing for precognition and that, and you know, remote viewing and telepathy, and then see the esoteric philosophies that tie into that, and there's no longer you know, the there's no longer the Southern Baptist where it's not fundamentalist enough to really cause a stir, but it does have a control over the culture. You know, the fundamentalisms are moving into their own area, so we can kind of step aside and say, well, okay, here's all these different traditions, and there's this underlying reality that we all share, you know, and start to engage with that.
Well, of course, that's, but in a way, that world that you're describing about, the world that's emerging where there's a conversation between certain aspects of science and psychology and esoteric practices, occult practices, meditational practices, that too is kind of its own world, because if you look at, you know, mainstream secular reality, I mean, they can't even, they're not even going to be, you know, start to go down these paths. And we're talking about a lot of people, not just a sort of surface level. And I think part of what this points to is that our whole mind frame of the our contemporary world is kind of splintering, where, you know, people can go down different kinds of paths, and any path you go down, people are, you know, that you're going to get feedback that supports that worldview, whether it's a very secular worldview or it's a very fundamentalist worldview, and the media is there, and the social networking is there, and the kind of, you know, in a way you had that wonderful phrase, there's this underlying reality to how we deal with reality. And I think one aspect of that underlying reality is that there's some kind of feedback mechanism, and which means that there really are kind of a multiplicity of ways of approaching things. And it's a really interesting one, because the question it leads me to ask is, how much is gained by directly engaging your ideological enemies versus plunging into, you know, the emerging networks of the things that seem to be working for you, or your material from the networks that you already kind of have? Because, you know, there's always this aspect, particularly in parapsychology. I mean, you know, pretty much everybody ignores esotericism unless they are paying attention to popular culture, where there's so much esoteric material that's being reformulated in terms of, you know, superheroes and all the sort of pop culture and gothic stuff and vampires and all that. But from, you know, a scientific view, who cares about that? And these, you know, paranormal people, they're just crazy. And there's an aspect of paranormal culture where they just so much want to prove it. They want to prove it. They want to get these guys to finally own it up, that yes, there's something statistical about these random number generators or whatever it is. But then right next door, it's like, hey, you know what? Don't waste too much of your time. There's so many other things to do.
Right.
Yeah.
That things are building off of. It's a very interesting moment that way. But I did have one question for you about the relationship.
Can I say something real quick with the skeptic thing? One of the things I love about blogging about this stuff and getting the information out there is if you put a story out there, and I submit some stuff to disinfo.com. And when I put a story up there, Disinfo has a very large secular humanist readership. And if I put something up on remote viewing, I'm going to hear back about it. Like, I'm going to hear, get torn apart by it, and it's awesome. Because it is, it's really great. Well, because you start to see, you know, the, like you said, you get stuck in this blind spot area where everybody's agreeing with each other, and it's, you know, you get these utopian ideas, and then you go out there and put the information out there and realize, well, whoa, wait a second, there's a whole bunch of people that don't think that at all, you know, and think you're crazy for talking about it. And then engaging in those conversations responsibly, you learn so much about your own blind spots, your own stuff. You know, and actually I was talking to John Kruth, who's the director of the Rhine Center, and one of the things he said is, for as much as the public conversation about, you know, the parapsychologist versus the skeptic, one of the things the skeptics have done is kept the parapsychologists honest and kept them at a level that even the skeptics admit the science that they do, when they do it right, is far above the level of a lot of what goes on. I mean, there's a lot of studies now where, you know, over 60% of biomedical stuff or over 50% of biomedical experiments can't be replicated, and that, but the parapsychology stuff can be replicated, and they do replicate it. So the skeptics play a really important role where they come in and, you know, they hit it hard and they may hit it irrationally, but because they do that, you're forced to go back and tighten up your own, you know, belief system and your own what you're engaged with.
That's a wonderful, wonderful comment. I mean, in the sense that it reflects, to my mind, part of what we learn about how reality gets constructed within a networked world where there's multiple perspectives, multiple, you know, kinds of networks, people doing different kinds of things, producing different sorts of claims about reality, is that those things begin to interact, and where the action happens is that interaction, which opens up, you know, further possibilities, rather than holding on to, a sort of enchanted world where everybody kind of agrees, which is always been my problem, or one of my problems with esotericism or with magical thinking or magical practices or this whole sort of alternative world, is that it's so desperate to affirm a kind of enchantment or a kind of possibility that's foreclosed by secular society, that it just the easiest way to do that is to build a big thick wall.
Right.
And go, okay, well, here, my friends agree, something weird happened to us, that proves it, that's all I need to know, where it seems like the action is really in the kind of turbulence that's created by continuing to explore those sort of edge possibilities while remaining in dialogue and in relationship with these other sometimes witheringly skeptical
You know? Well, and that I think is, Eric, so important, and why it is everyone feels they need to prove it, and why it is like someone has this crazy experience and then they want to, like, what is the drive behind it? And I think a lot of it goes back to what David said, is that there is this underlying reality, under reality, that's the same for everybody. And I think part of the impetus that is like going on there with all of this, and why people have this thing to prove, and why it is something that can be repeatable, is there's something that's the same that's going on that we can't see, right? And I think that a big part of it, like why they want to like go through all the effort, and, you know, like David said, that it's so good that the skeptics are pushing them to so that they can see it. So there's something going on that is, it's uniform, that is like anybody
right.
can have this happen if they do A, B, C, D. Like you can go into a trance if you do X, Y, Z, whether you're in the Amazon or whether you're in New York City, and
right.
then get into that same, they're all going to the same place.
Well, here's a question I have about this, because you brought up practice. You know, here's some techniques and da-da-da. And sometimes I wonder, I ask myself, you know, now we're at this moment where there's this extraordinary explosion of information on practices, on different techniques, on different, you know, even not just specific techniques, but just whole ways of living life, of being in the body, of working with mind, of working with dream, of working with practical magic, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's a lot of what you're putting out there, David. You're sifting through this stuff. You're finding quality material. And like you're saying, and part of what you're doing is you're just putting it out there. And there's a sense that, like, somewhere down the line, something is happening with that material. But the thing that I kind of wonder sometimes is, like, this is sort of happening to, you know, to everybody. I mean, everybody is now in various ways plugging themselves into this, constantly forwarding kind of matrix of information where you're, you know, sending on URLs and here's this thing and here's this bit of information, here's a technique that I found out about, and da-da-da. And sometimes I go, well, who's actually doing this stuff? I mean, some people are doing it, obviously, but, you know, it's something else happening that it's almost not even about the kind of tools that are made available for people, or is there a kind of resurgence of people who are saying, yeah, I could spend all day online researching and, you know, getting more esoteric data on the various ways that people have dealt with dreams or sexual energy or whatever it is, but instead, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go, like, and start really working with this stuff and really seeing how far we can take it in experience. And
yeah. And
I don't know, and I really don't know, so I'm kind of genuinely curious. Do you have the sense that people are really pushing the boundaries on their own experiences as well, or are we in some kind of like weird like information phase of this kind of material?
I wonder that too. I think that that's a really interesting question, because that's something that I think about quite often with myself, with the amount of information I pour through, the amount of time that I have to actually do stuff. You know, I was talking to somebody about lucid dreaming, and, you know, I've had successful lucid dreaming experiences, but because of my schedule, it's really hard to get back to that. You know, when I did it, I had time to do it. Now, you know, going through all this information and having that information out there, you know, I think that's a really valid question, because in a way, the information gathering and information culture itself becomes a technique. You know, I mean, you can have Twitter synchronicities or social media synchronicities and stuff like that, but yeah, the actual, you know, meditation practices and the alchemical work, you know, I'm fascinated with the practical alchemy, but to take the time to do it, you know, Maji, you pointed out, you've got to be in tune with the, you know, the celestial happenings and all
and
that.
Well, and it's work, too. It's hard work, and that's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, I do this stuff, and I do it in groups. Like, I did a lucid dream group that was awesome. We slept in a Mason building, and there was about 13 of us, and we all had the plan to meet in that room.
Oh, nice.
And there was over 50% of the people actually made it to the location, and then the themes or the archetypes in everyone's dreams were exactly the same. So it was very good. But I'll find, like, I'll organize something like a, you know, meditation, and I'll do work with Kelvin DeWolf over at First Defense doing Taoist meditation techniques. And we get, all these people are very interested online, like on Facebook and stuff, but then you get like a handful of people that are actually willing to sit down and get their hands dirty and like do the work and sit there patiently. And they do show up, but it's way more that are interested informationally than will actually like participate.
Right. And that's, yeah, I think that is an issue. And that was an interesting point too, Eric, with is this kind of like a precursor moment, you know, where all this information gets out there, and then will we have that practical, you know, moment where we start to implement that? Because, I mean, I can't imagine trying to organize, you know, that stuff. That incubation, the dream incubation, is really interesting, because at the parapsychological conference, they talked about at the I want to say it's the International Association of Dream Studies at their conference. That's actually a game that they play every year because of the Mamemides Medical Center studies on dream telepathy. After they got such good results from that, and that's one of the better ESP experiments that actually has more extreme results. That they actually started doing that every year at these conferences, where they would choose, you know, random target pictures, and then whoever, you know, then they would come back every day and report their dreams and see who could get the target picture, you know, and so they play these games with it. But yeah, I mean, getting that together and having the time to do it. And the other thing too is, I think that, you know, we're all fortunate in that we work in this, but people that have a 9-to-5 job and, you know, may not have the time to engage in that. And it is kind of a cultural specific thing where, you know, somebody who's running a company, that then they go home to their family, and that, you know, they may not have the time to actually implement some of
Or they'll face
more.
Stigmatism as a result. Like, they can't tell people, yeah, I just went and did this ritual.
you know?
Or they'll get fired or something like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was something I worried about early on when I was, you know, like I said before, with in the marketing agency. That was one of my hesitancies, was if I start writing about this stuff, is it going to completely isolate me from ever, you know, having another professional contact?
Yeah.
And I asked people about that, and folks, you know, were pretty supportive that, you know, I think it was at the time I was testing LinkedIn and kind of learning LinkedIn and stuff like that. And I posted on a writer's group, like, if I write about this stuff, is it going to isolate me? And somebody from the UN, some UN rep, was in the same group, and he was like, oh, no, you know, like, a lot of people are interested in that, you know. So I went for it, you know. But
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I have some of the similar, you know, concerns as I get in more into academia and think about different ways of teaching. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of people, even people who study this material, in fact, especially people who study this material, who are very, very leery of any kind of sign of active interest or even personal exploration or a sort of genuinely open mind. I mean, you know, Jeff Kripal is an unusual, he's an anomaly
here. And I, you know, and I've thought about that, and I've talked to other people about it, and even earlier in my freelance writing career, just being, you know, reasonably open about some of my, you know, more outlier experiences. And what I've come to, and, you know, and part of it's just this is the choice that I made, and so I'm going to affirm it, is that it's part of that earlier point you made about the need and the healthiness of having these networks where people from different parts of society, art, science, business, you know, scholarship, are in open conversation and are finding and building a medium place where these different dimensions can coexist, and that's something that we do with our own practice and our own decisions. So that, in a way, is it's actually a really deep ethical question, how open you are about these things in your quote-unquote normal life, because by being open about it, you're actually building that place where those conversations can happen, which is a lot of what this whole show is about and the kind of work that you're doing. But David, we got to wrap it up. I just want to thank you so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is great.
And, you know, check out David Metcalf. You know how to search stuff online. You'll find him. And check out the Twitter feed. From me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.